funded.
Right.
Keep coming back.
You and I.
It shouldn't be.
Great.
All right, the House Interim Committee on Veterans Emergency Preparedness is now in session. In about 2 minutes or so, we'll get to the organizational meeting part of the day, but as is custom for the Vets and Emergency Preparedness Committee, we spend a few moments at the beginning to remind ourselves why we're here. It only seems like it's been a month and a half since we were here, but across the force, across the military, there have been casualties, both six engaged in activities with adversaries, and 17 resulting from collisions of overworked, overstressed Navy ships. If we ever doubt the price of trying to make sure that people are living in a place where freedom, democracy, opportunity to become who you want to become, the opportunity to say what you want to say within reason, that price is borne both in hot wars and cold wars by people that are wearing the uniform. On this 70th anniversary of the forming of the United States Air Force, I also want to say thanks to all the folks who ever served in blue and all the folks that served with them. And again today, I'm looking forward to hearing reports about all the good things going on that are trying to make sure that both this state is kept safe and secure from threats today, fires, et cetera, as well as taking care of our veterans. So thank you for attending the House Veterans Committee on Veterans Emergency Preparedness. All right. We're going to open an organizational meeting. This organizational meeting is now open. We understand we have a one slight change to the rules for committee rules having to do with an option for how we record field trips. Instead of it being just recorded, you can also now have a written summary. I'm not exactly certain why that needed its own rule change, but somebody thought that it did, and that's reflected in our rules. And the chair would certainly entertain a motion to adopt the rules of organization for the committee. Okay.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated this 18th of September.
Representative Escoval moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 18th. Is there any discussion? Okay. Seeing no discussion, let's call the roll.
Representative Lewis.
Aye.
Representative Lively.
Aye.
Representative Meek.
Aye.
Representative Parrish.
Excused.
Representative Post.
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone.
Aye.
Vice Chair Escoval.
Aye.
Chair Evans.
Aye. And in a squeaker, rules pass. What we're going to do now, thank you, everybody, for getting us to have the rules so we can actually operate. What we're going to do now, it is customary during the interim committee, the first meeting of the interim committee, for people to do a brief introduction so people know each other. Most of us were on the same committee before, but we have some staff folks that are new, so I'm going to start to the far left. And if you could just say your name and what you do, and we'll go around the dais, and then we'll proceed with the rest of the agenda.
Kayla Byers, committee assistant.
Rick Lewis, state representative of District 18.
Excellent.
Mark Meek, House District 40, Oregon City Gladstone, and United States Air Force. Vet.
Representative Sal Escobar, representative District 6, Medford, Vietnam veteran, United States Navy.
Chair Paul Evans, grateful to be here.
Senator Philly Moihala, I'm an LPRO analyst.
I want you to say that again. I'm giving him a bad time. Deborah Boone, I represent the upper left, the beautiful upper left coast.
John Lively, I represent House District 12, which is the city of Springfield.
Bill Post, District 25, Kaiser St. Paul and Newburgh.
Kaiser St. Paul and Newburgh. That's awesome. All right. All right. So that is the committee lineup for today. We're going to proceed with the rest of the agenda. We have a lot to cover. The goal is to get everybody out of here by 4:20, much smarter than, well, for us to be much smarter than we started. You guys know what you're going to be saying. And we're going to open an informational meeting, invite up. We're going to close the organizational meeting, open the informational meeting, invite up Director Smith and anybody else you'd like to bring up. And for the next 20 minutes, we are yours.
Good
Good afternoon, Chair Evans, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Cameron Smith, the director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and it does feel like we were just here, but welcome back. And we have Jimmy Lee here as our representative of both Air and Army service, but today only his Air service counts on the 70th anniversary of our Air Force. But if I can indulge, so we handed out our annual report for 2017, and there's copies on the side for anyone in the audience. But to start with that cadence theme, I want to get us all motivated here. So let's see if this works.
Up, up, hip, up, the heads are up, the chests are out, the horns are swinging and cadence out. Sound off.
1, 2.
Sound off.
3, 4.
Cadence count.
1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Eeny, meeny, miny, moe. Let's go back and count some more. Sound off.
1, 2.
Sound off.
3, 4.
Cadence count.
1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4.
All right, so just a little taste of that cadence call, known as the Duckworth Chant, but ends up getting folks in step, marching in unison, motivating folks forward, would even get our Air Force to charge into battle here. And that was the theme that we had for this year's annual report.
My dad didn't, he said those weren't quite that clean.
Now, we picked a cleaner version.
On behalf of many, thank you for not picking the ones that we learned.
Really naughty ones. Some others that are inappropriate. So that cadence, not just getting folks in step, but we have more than a rhythm or pace. A cadence is an infectious appeal to keep moving forward. And this is our veterans landscape that you guys know oh so well, but where we were about 320,000 veterans, now the latest and greatest estimate out of the federal VA is 310,000 veterans across the state. With that age range of era of service, but over 50% of our veterans age 65 plus. Representative Esquivel mentioned his Vietnam service, so this is largely our Vietnam vets backward through Korean War and World War II as well. Here's the breakout by the actual era of the combat eras. And I would just highlight that Vietnam War generation, almost 38% of our veterans population, the largest segment of our veterans population and will be for a long time to come. Not welcomed home in their own time, and now in this 50th anniversary year, last night, I believe, was the start of the Vietnam War documentary, a long-part series by Ken Burns, highlighting both overseas and at home for that period. But out of that partnership, doing some great public service announcements to reach out to Vietnam veterans and veterans across the state to better connect them to our work.
It's a great ad, by the way.
Thank you.
It was really, really nice.
They ended up cutting me out of the PSA as a face, and then they ended up cutting me out as the voiceover, so we're good to go. As long as we have ODVA plugged, we're good.
Trying to give him a compliment. I'm just saying, it was a good ad.
So almost 30,000 claims submitted in the last fiscal year. That's off of 10% more VSOs, and this is all a backwards look for our annual report. So this is not the prospective forward out of this last session. But now almost 85 veteran service officers across the state. Of those claims, so some of those are education claims. Some of them are turning on and off again your benefits. But in terms of new claims for a new issue that a veteran is submitting disability compensation for, almost 13,400 with 11,000 new power of attorneys. And as a comparison on the power of attorneys, going back to 2013, we were at about 8,000 individuals having power of attorney, now over 13,000. Of the new claims, in 2015, we were 6,000, now that 13,400 number. So a significant amount of outreach, and then almost 500 appellate hearings. When claims are denied and veterans still feel like they've got a dog in the hunt, where our VSOs at the statewide level represent on appellate work. So for all of that output of effort, it draws down that $116 million per month, now almost $1.4 billion per year in disability compensation, and now a larger number of veterans receiving service-connected compensation, over 75,000 veterans across the state. And again, looking back, we were $1.1 billion in 2013, now $1.4 billion. So an extra $300 million of cash coming into Oregon's veterans' bank accounts and wallets every year. This is an average annual payment of $15,229, which is 10% above the national average of $14,600. And roughly two-thirds of all Oregon veterans that submit a claim through our County Veteran Service Officers and ODVA are rated at some level successful for a disability service-connected compensation or low-income pension. Beyond that core program of veteran services with the County Veteran Service Officers, our first and longest program, Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs Home Loan Program, separate and distinct from the federal VA guarantee, a little over $70 million lent at that below market interest rate for Oregon veterans. Over 500 residents, both veterans and their spouses, assisted at the two veterans' homes, have come down a little bit on our numbers for the DALS census for veterans and spouses living there as we complete a remodel. So kind of shutting down one opportunity and shifting folks was just up there Friday. And in this 20th anniversary year of the Veterans Home in the DALS will be a great ribbon cutting on a renovated space later this year for them. Out of the new home, Lebanon, had been open for 2 years and became fully occupied, full census, and on their path of excellence now at the Bronze Award for that national skilled nursing profession in long-term care. Also, the $27 million that we manage under conservatorship for about 145 veterans, another core program in our Aging Veteran Services Division. So Cadence is both looking backwards, but it's also looking forward. So it is where we've been, but also where we're going forward. So this is what we closed session with here about a month and a half ago. Now $26.1 million of general fund and lottery fund that is flowing for Oregon veterans with that significant investment out of the Measure 96 lottery funds. So where are those dollars going generally? We always had that pitch of some of it staying at statewide veteran services at ODVA. But with your leadership and the Senate side leadership and the governor's leadership to drive those funds down to the local level, whether it's with county veteran service officers, whether it's with national service organizations and new community partner grants that we are standing up. So here are the specifics out of the Measure 96 lottery funds. So $4.5 million to double the current service level funding for both the county veteran service offices and the national service organizations, retaining some at the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs to shift off of home loan program resources that were dwindling to continue to provide core services through ODVA. The new $1.5 million I'll highlight to which is not flowing through ODVA, but flows through the Oregon Housing and Community Services, but will be a leverage opportunity. Some of it will pass directly through, likely to community action agencies here shortly. About $350,000 was dedicated immediately and appropriated immediately out of last session. The remainder of that they've asked through a budget note for ODVA and the Oregon Housing and Community Services to pitch a plan back to the February session of where we think we can get the most opportunity from those remaining leveraged funds. The new opportunity to better support student veteran success on campus with a new program for a grant fund was $1.2 million, $500,000 to establish a grant fund similarly for nonprofit and community partner efforts, really looking at how we can pilot to those organizations that are also serving veterans, other efforts that the legislature might be able to or ODVA might be able to double down on in the future. $350,000 for a suicide crisis line to continue dedicated to veterans, a veteran volunteer program, a coordinator position that will stand up a veteran volunteer program, and then $2.3 million held in reserve for future appropriate. It will always be dedicated in that Veteran Services Fund, whether for future legislature or either in the 18 or 19 session. Beyond that, so we took a little bit of drop in our general fund from about 10.5 to about that 7.5 number to compensate for that difference off of an increase in cigarette tax revenue, I believe. There was $20 million total, and through a budget note, $2.5 million of that will be dedicated to improving veterans' access to mental health resources. So we've begun that partnership, just like we have with housing and homeless prevention with Oregon Housing Community Services, similarly working with OHA leadership to model. If we divided this across a two-year budget, roughly $1 million bucks a year across 36 counties, would be about $27,000 per county. Knowing that it's not going to impact the 300,000-plus veterans, we're looking for how can we get system impacts with these dollars to try to better leverage what is a significant resource in healthcare space overall. So the things under discussion there, whether it's peer-to-peer treatment programs, whether it's educating providers about military and veterans issues, whether we're trying to get a position at OHA that is dedicated, a veterans health liaison position, to begin to drive across public health outcomes, coordinated care organizations, and other efforts to make sure we're bringing that veterans experience to bear. We also had significant investments through capital construction bill, $2.5 million for renovations, both in Lebanon and the Dalles, next iteration projects, and $10.5 million authorized for a third Oregon veterans home that has long been in statute for Roseburg. And a lot of great discussions, both across the chair, going back to D.C., and working with our federal VA counterparts. What does a next-generation veterans home look like that might be able to model assisted living, secure memory care, and some other innovative options to better fill that gap of what our aging veterans are experiencing? And then just one last plug on, I don't know if it was capital construction or through one of the final end-of-session bills, but Representative Esquivel, who has long been talking about raising money through selling bricks, which we still need to do, but now a significant contribution from the state of $250,000 to the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Wall replica project down in his district, down in southern Oregon. And we called out a few in this annual report. This is not every veterans bill, and we have a larger email distro blast list that we send every bill as a closing, but these were some of the ones that highlighted for us. The ones that I think the chair and all of you are most interested in terms of where are we with the Veteran Services Grant and the student veteran one, have begun to better model what that student veteran one is first. We'll develop the rules and put those out. Then we'll model what the Veteran Services Grant, which is a little more flexible. It could be housing. It could be serving incarcerated veterans. It could be tribal efforts. But with the goal for both of those to have the rules written over the next month, to have that RFP go out to both to community colleges, universities, or the nonprofit and community providers to try to get their best and brightest ideas of where the gaps are by the end of this year, to have the money flowing by January so that we can have a year's track record in 2018. To then drive into the 2019 session, depending on the successes and the outcomes of those grants. I think those are the two ones. The main budget notes on that mental health and on the housing, those two bills in particular, I think, are the most hot to trot for us right now. We've had to prioritize both off of new positions bringing on, in addition to the hiring freeze, some of the new positions. We'll be bringing on Sharon Blasey from the Secretary of State office, who helped do our veterans review and audit in 2013 and 2014. She's going to be coming on board as our Assistant Director of Statewide Veteran Services, another Navy veteran. So we can't even say...
You're in good hands.
Can't even say our chief in Mitch Sparks is going to be supervised by a Marine, but... She served almost 14 years in the Navy, has had almost equally as much time on that performance management from the Secretary of State's office, and will be a great, while Mitch's expertise and our team's expertise on claims, she's going to be able to help link us, not just to make our own programs better, but to better link us across housing, healthcare, mental health, economic development, and opportunity. The only other thing that I would highlight in the short term, in terms of, a hugely successful session, and a huge thank you to the bipartisan leadership on this committee and under Chair Boquist and on the Senate side. It was an incredible session and a lot of good that we're hearing out in the veterans community. In terms of our work going forward, some opportunities that we highlight, continued opportunities on incarcerated veterans and better connecting them, trying to strengthen and institutionalize what's been a good partnership with Oregon Housing and Community Services, but some housing and homeless veteran concepts, and then really wanting to try to model, we've done some work around veteran-owned businesses, that have either a service-connected disability status and they get preference in state contracting, but also looking at just certifying veteran-owned businesses generally, even if they don't get a preference, to build that core of who are our veterans business owner community. And then still looking with the chair and others, how do we better model some of the apprenticeship efforts, that helmets to hard hats opportunity that we think is out there in that employment space as well. I will wrap up there and happy to take any questions.
Great report. Questions? Representative Parrish.
Thanks. Always have questions. Thank you for the presentation. I appreciate it. Two things you mentioned. Let's start with the more positive thing. Connecting the veteran businesses. Are you working with the corporations division at all to see what kind of resources they have so that we are, not sort of double dipping what they're trying to do? I don't know if they are trying to do anything at all. Maybe they're not, but I'd be curious to see what that relationship looks like, since the front door of business really is walking through the corporations division and not the VA, how we might be better utilizing that office to connect whatever resources there are for veteran-owned businesses when they file their paperwork at the Secretary of State's office, and get their business going. So I don't know if there's a way that, as we send out letters or ask them to check off their box that, hey, this is a veteran-owned business, collect that data back, that no wrong door, maybe we should be doing it when you sign up to start your business, so that you can get that information back, that they have an understanding of that, there might be some additional opportunities for business resources or whatever, but I think that maybe that's a missed opportunity on our part to not have that relationship. So that would be the more comment than anything, but I know every time I've ever filled out a form at the Corporations Division, there's nothing on there about veteran status, so that would be a place I think we could do some work in the short session.
But by law, there's supposed to be something on the forms, but Director Smith, take it away.
Chair Evans, Representative Parrish. So Secretary of State's Corporation Division is a great partner, and if there's more we can do, we'll follow up with them. But both Ruth Miles, it's kind of been the trifecta of Secretary of State's Corporation Division, Business Oregon, and then also DAS procurement quite a bit gets into it in terms of a lot of the state contracting. So we've been trying to build that better partnership with them, in addition to federal entities from GCAP and others, Small Business Administration, some of the Chamber of Commerce entities. But it's a space we've never staffed it necessarily at our level, so it's been somewhat of a scattered shot partnership. As we get out of the student veteran concept, we'll have a student veteran coordinator, so we'll begin to better align ourselves. But this is a great opportunity for us to better to be an ongoing resource on our end of that convening power.
Yeah, because I think when you just go to register a business, it doesn't really ask you. I'm just going to their forms. I don't think there's anything on the forms that say, are you a veteran-owned business? Because if there are, capital resources in terms of just business capital or whatever, I think there's just, it's an opportunity. Anyway, I won't belabor that.
We'll follow up on that point, because that was a subject of a law in 2009.
Yeah.
So. And it certainly is on every state website. I think the forms might have been the bridge too far that then got rebooted to every state website has that link. I'll have to double check on the technicality.
And then what I'm hearing, sort of just boots on the ground, so this more on the nonprofit, particularly the you know, recognized veterans organizations is just maybe some concern that communication's not as wonderful as it could be about where do these lottery dollars and how are they going to flow down to, you know, trying to help get VSOs like at the VFW or at the Legion or wherever. And so that's just more feedback than anything that I think that there is still some dismay over what the ultimate budget wound up looking like, and then how those dollars are going to flow out into the community and when that's going to happen. And I don't know if you are or aren't communicating that information with them, but that is definitely something that I'm hearing a lot of and getting text messages about from people who are like, wait a minute, where's this money coming from? The session's over and how's it going to start moving? So however we can get that communicated to folks, I think, is really important.
And Chair Evans, Representative Parrish, I think in terms of our national service organizations, which I think are the ones that are raising their voices the most, not mm-hmm. as much the nonprofit partners. So when we doubled, we took that equal approach of doubling the county VSO pass-through and doubling the national service organization pass-through. But one started at about $4 million level because it was that historic appropriation level. One was only about $114,000. So we applied that same doubling metric in this budget out of those Measure 96 dollars. And I think some of the service orgs, and so we are also rejiggering our formula on the service organization side to try to better honor those organizations that are doing the majority of the claims work mm-hmm. of American Legion, VFW, and disabled American veterans. But even with that, it will only be about $30,000 a year going to those service organizations. Not enough necessarily to solely cover the pay and benefits of a service officer. And I think to kind of put some comparison on it, we're about at that $230,000 for service organizations as a total in the budget. When VFW was proposing both to Ways and Means and other partners, and I believe here as well, they were looking for $250,000 appropriation just directly just to VFW. So it is something that we need to consider going forward, whether out of the reserves or some of the other funds. Was that a conscious decision by the legislature? Should we relook at that as another opportunity? But some of the service organizations are having trouble off of their own membership or off of the financing of their organizations maintaining that veteran service office position.
But they have VFW, for example, can put in, once the rules are established for the non-partner, for the nonprofit partner, they could theoretically put in an application
Correct.
For additional resources.
Chair Evans, I would say almost anyone can apply for that $500,000 grant that will stand up this year.
It likely won't be awarded in one $500,000 grant.
So, I mean, the rules as written in that bill were about, I think it was $25,000 grants up to a maximum of $250,000. But the general legislative intent off of that and what we are running with as the intent was that it's for gaps. So you're unlikely to see a suicide crisis line being funded off of it because that's an existing line item. You're unlikely to see county veteran service officers putting a grant request in for another VSO at a county level. The legislature has spoken of where for those line items where they're spoken. But I think you could see, and I think it'll be interesting to see whether they do apply for that and whether it rises to the top. I think there's a significant opportunity and gap on outreach that the service organizations could be doing. It's hard for us to speak to the quality of the claims work because they aren't falling under our power of attorney for review or appellate
And that's
work.
Sort of where I wanted to go is, you know, something this committee might want to consider is building in some metrics and saying, okay, where are veterans really initiating those claims? Is it at the county or is it, you know, sort of through your local VFW hall because of where veterans want to connect? And so I don't think we have ever seen in the 7 years I've been on this committee data that says a county VSO, you know, average generates this compared to a nonprofit VSO. Is generating this, and if you backed out and try to kind of make it apples to apples based on how much FTE they were actually doing, what percentage, and who's doing a better job at that? And I think that's almost a missing data point in our future decision to fund VSOs. Is it really the guy at the campus who's doing the best job, or is it?
Well, the guy at the campus shouldn't be doing it now. They're their resource. The county VSO may be going to the campus.
But you know what I mean? It's right. Like someone who is officially from the government and I'm here to help versus somebody who is the nonprofit guy who, you know, especially when we know that there is a portion of those folks just don't trust anybody from the government. We probably need some good data that compares efficacy of where that outreach happens and then really rethink where those dollars should be distributed. And I think that that's something I'd like to see at some point.
So just to sum up before we move on, you'd like data looking at the variable or at least the respective outcomes related to nonprofits, national service organizations, county VSOs, mm-hmm. as far as the number of claims filed, if we can get that, and or the number of contacts made, perhaps maybe easier for them.
Value of the claims, and whatever it is.
If we could have something approximating that before November, that'd be great.
Sure.
Other questions before we move to the next category? Yes, sir. And yes, sir.
Yes. How do you, you stated in here we have 310,000 veterans in the state of Oregon. How do we know that, and if so, do we have addresses and everything on these people, or what? How do we know we have 310,000 somewhat veterans?
Chair Evans, Representative Esquivel, so this is off of the Veterans POP data from the federal VA, the best estimate, but it is not a by name rank order and speaks to why we do outreach to try to pull those folks in. I would say one essential piece, and it's our best estimate that we have, but it is still an estimate. And many states feel like they have more veterans out there or more of an impact or differences in opinion. But getting that question, have you or a loved one served in the military, are you a veteran, onto the next census is an essential. It was on, I believe, I'd have to confirm whether it was part of the 2010 census or not.
2000, not 2010.
So not having it on the 2010 one hurt the strength of that estimate significantly. Now, granted, it equally hurts all states. So, I mean, it is our best estimate out of where the Fed VA says the number of veterans are. But having that question on the 2010 or 2020 census would be essential to further firm up. That would be our best that would be our best way to get it.
Mr. Chair, mm-hmm. reason I say this is because, you know, we have the VSOs and we have the county and we have them in campuses, but majority of your people aren't on campus. The majority of your people are out working someplace and they're earning a living and or retired. So that's the ones I want to figure out a way to let them know that they need to check in on their veterans' benefits.
Hopefully they're tuning in this next 2 weeks. To OPB for the Vietnam War.
Isn't that a great series so far?
It's a great series, and, I mean, quite frankly, getting people where they live.
And already folks who never knew ODVA or service officers existed seeing that flagged and calling in. I would say one of the best tools that we have in terms of the state are those universal places that we think most of our citizens have to go, like DMV, to register a vehicle. So having that as a pivot point, having revenue as a pivot point does help to further identify, have you served and would you like benefit information and further connecting to an advocate.
Representative Lewis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned earlier about the mental health, the $2.5 million that goes to Oregon Health Authority. I'm looking at Senate Bill 81, where it tasks ODVA with assisting veterans to obtain the health care, including mental health care, via federal, state, and local health care systems. I think you said that you'll have a liaison with Oregon Health Authority, but my question really is, who do we rely on as a committee to get data on, for example, the numbers of clients that they're serving that are veterans, what types of issues they're seeing? Is that going to come from you, or would that come from Oregon Health Authority?
Chair Evans, Representative Lewis, I think your question gets to the crux of most of our effort. There are a lot of discussions going on in the healthcare policy committee that are putting OHA, the Association of Oregon County Mental Health, and other local providers on the hook for healthcare transformation and delivery of behavioral health systems and mental health. But they aren't always bringing that veterans lens or perspective to it. Here, we're bringing that veteran's lens, but don't necessarily control through ODVA those broad performance outcomes or programs. So how we've been trying to structure ourselves, Marion County will be the last, so we were proud to stand up Polk County beginning of this year. We will be aiming with Marion County support and leadership to be standing up Marion County Veteran Service Office January of 2018 to be that 36th and final county at the local level. As they take on that boots on the ground and transition, internally we'll be able to reposition some of our staff at ODVA less into that boots on the ground claims representation and more into these different advocates across either policy areas or populations. So internally we see a way to try to get to a veterans health navigator where we didn't attach a position to, was it 81, did you say? Mm-hmm. Senate Bill 81. And was simply a concept of we need to get ODVA and our service officers more into this space. So that's how we're beginning to try to model that we'll have someone on our side thinking healthcare and thinking mental health care. For the $2.5 million of cigarette tax revenue, we think one, you know, if you took 10% of that and built a position within kind of an operations or policy analyst or program analyst level, to be able to have someone on their end that is waking up every day thinking veterans, going to bed every night thinking veterans, to have that longer term, because the 2.5 in and of itself is not going to change the outcomes of 300,000 plus veterans. It's going to be getting the larger systems. I mean, we pride ourselves in Oregon about getting everyone around the table and discussing an issue. We pride ourselves on coordinated care as an effective and efficient tool. We've never brought federal VA and the $1 billion of healthcare spending every year into that conversation. That's a missed opportunity. We see it wholly and want it, but we don't have that given all the other opportunities that OHA is working on. We think having a staff position over there would better infuse that into the, and then it's just one little world of CCOs, much less public health and suicide prevention and the other partnerships, because it's the larger systems at play that are going to better serve veterans.
One follow-up question, Mr. Chair. Has there been any discussion yet with the Oregon Health Authority about making sure that when those mental health services are provided for veterans, that they have counselors or staff that know, have perhaps been there themselves and they know the veterans' issues? Because I know a lot of veterans that I talk to that probably could benefit from some of those services won't talk to somebody unless they have the military background and the experience. So my hope is there's going to be a connection there somewhere.
Chair Evans, Representative Lewis, one of our pitches back to them, and I think resonated to them, was I don't know that it's cultural competency, but we are a unique population with unique experiences, young to old, men and women, urban and rural. Having that awareness, whether you're a provider on mental health or regular physical health and a choice provider or providing TRICARE, about one-third of our veterans feed into VA health care. The rest are served in the community, but often those providers are not aware that they're serving a veteran unless they kind of wear that on their sleeve and bring that up. So educating providers could be a great leveraged opportunity for that 2.5. Again, it's not direct delivery of services, but makes that direct delivery of services hugely value added.
Thank you.
And similar to what we've had with the military crisis line, it's a suicide prevention line that speaks veteran, that speaks military, and understands the challenges.
All right. Thank you, Director Smith. If folks have follow-up questions, I know that there are. We will try to get you offline and follow up on that. Look forward to hearing more about the many things that are going on. Thank you very much for the good report. We're going to move on in the agenda to the, and we're actually strangely on time, Eclipse Preparedness. Mr. Phelps and Mr. Devereaux, you're next. Please come on up.
I think it's over, isn't it? How'd that turn out?
The sun didn't fall, so there's that.
I can see you.
My kids did get blind.
Please introduce yourselves and go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Evans, members of the committee. My name is Andrew Phelps, and I am the director of the Oregon Office of Emergency Management. Pleased to brief the committee today on the planning efforts leading up to the activation of the State Emergency Coordination Center during the Great American Eclipse this past August. Short version, it got dark for 2 minutes. End of brief. Of course, to that 2 minutes. Hourglass upside down again. Leading up to that 2 minutes of darkness, of course, was months of planning, not just at the state level, but with our local, tribal, and federal partners as well. Just a quick overview of the eclipse itself. The first visibility of this total eclipse on the continental United States was right here in Oregon. It came ashore in Newport just about 9 o'clock in the morning on August the 21st, and it departed the state at 11:46 a.m. just outside of Ontario, Oregon. Well, that might seem like a long time. There's the time zone difference, so it was really only in the state for about an hour and a half to 2 hours. Totality itself lasted about 2 minutes, beginning around 10:15 Pacific time, and was the first solar eclipse visible on the continental United States since 1979, so a pretty big deal. Across the state, the emergency management community viewed this as an opportunity to exercise our capabilities in an environment that mirrored the requirements of our function during an emergency or disaster, but without many of the stressors that are found in an actual disaster. This experience far exceeded any exercise I've ever participated in, but that in a lot of ways is what this was, a disaster response exercise. The planning effort involved the development at the state level of a special event plan, which was built with partners on several key objectives, including conducting a unified planning process, establishing a joint information system and center, establishing robust communications and maintaining communications throughout the event, and the ensuring of public safety for all who chose to view the eclipse here in Oregon. There was a planning assumption that 1 million visitors would be in Oregon for this eclipse. That number was based on the number of hotel rooms and campsites that were booked, as well as populations within driving distance to the path of totality here in Oregon. Much has been made about the 1 million visitors number. We found ourselves in a position of almost having to apologize for not having death and destruction during the eclipse that I think some folks maybe had anticipated. But it's important to understand that that was, in fact, a planning assumption. Much like we prepare for a 9.0 earthquake, if we have a Cascadia earthquake and it's an 8.4, I don't think we'll be too terribly disappointed with that, and the same planning process applies. In addition to the actual planning process, we also worked with our local and state partners on the concepts of disaster or emergency declarations. Now, we, unlike our hurricane state partners, don't typically do emergency declaration in advance of something bad or potentially overwhelming happening, like a hurricane. However, it was determined that the state could be best positioned to facilitate a response by doing an emergency declaration, and the governor did so on the 14th of August. And this was able to facilitate mutual aid and waive certain rules and regulations that state agencies have that could inhibit or prohibit an effective state response. That declaration did sunset on August 24th. That's right, the eclipse declaration had a sunset clause in it. Local declarations were also made by Harney County, Lincoln County, and Baker County. Thank you, sir. I want to bring up, too, that one of the requirements to utilize the Emergency Management Assistance Compact, or EMAC, which is an interstate mutual aid system allowing states to share resources among themselves during emergency situations, that's predicated on having a state emergency declaration. It would just so happen that wildfires seemed to break out just as we were getting ready for the eclipse, and some of the National Guard helicopters that we had anticipated utilizing on a standby medevac basis for the eclipse were called to the firefight. We ended up using a resource from the state of California, UH-60 Black Hawk medevac helicopter, to come into Oregon and be on standby in Baker City for the eclipse. This was the first time the state of Oregon has ever requested resources through the Emergency Management Assistance Compact. It was a pretty significant step for our office, and I think for the state. It was also the first time EMAC has ever been used to respond to an eclipse. The ECC, we had a plan on how we would staff the Emergency Coordination Center. we were to take an enhanced watch posture, meaning state emergency management staff would be monitoring the events leading up to the eclipse from 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. beginning the Wednesday prior and continuing through Sunday with a full ECC activation on that Monday. And then if things went well, transition back to the enhanced watch posture on Tuesday. The onslaught of wildfires and the coordination that was required by our agency for ESF-6 mass care and sheltering operations, as well as some other operational and coordination issues associated with the Emergency Management Assistance Compact, necessitated an activation of the ECC beginning that Saturday. So we had three full days of ECC activation, and that continued really until Tuesday the 22nd and sporadically since then. This response to the Emergency Coordination Center also included FEMA positioning staff within the Emergency Coordination Center, as well as at the Multi-Agency Command Center in Bend, outside of Bend in Redmond, Oregon. This also was the first time FEMA has deployed resources to an eclipse. So a lot of firsts happened with this particular event. We had a federal coordinating officer in the ECC, incident management assistant team members, and MERS response vehicles, which are mobile emergency response system vehicles that support communication and medical needs, both here in Salem and in Redmond. We also had OEM liaisons deployed to emergency operations centers in Newport, Redmond, John Day, and Baker City, but given the flexible nature of emergency management, our Newport liaison was called back to assist with EMAC requests through the wildfire situation, and after the Newport and Lincoln County emergency management folks determined they had things well in hand. Other agency operations centers, including the Joint Operations Center at the Oregon National Guard, were also activated during this time. Many emergencies and large planned events are public information events as much as anything else, and I think you've heard me say that a number of times. We did activate a joint information center from 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. Thursday through Tuesday throughout the entire event. That's the 17th of August through the 22nd of August. And over a dozen agencies and local partners, including the American Red Cross, participated in that activation of the joint information center. This allowed us to have connectivity with local and regional joint information centers, provide rumor control, and we activated our virtual operations support team to listen to social media and help identify conversations happening on social media that could be impactful to incident commanders throughout the state, as well as identify resource gaps or information gaps in official information being provided by that Joint Information Center. The key messages were plan ahead, practice wildfire safety, maintain health, heat, and sanitation best practices, especially when off the grid, so to speak, know the routes, emergency vehicle access rules and regulations, and be aware of traffic situations via the Oregon Department of Transportation's website. We also wanted to make sure that folks knew the See Something, Say Something message. A lot of folks coming into Oregon, and we have this tendency, I think, to assume someone else maybe has called 911 to report something suspicious or out of the ordinary. We wanted folks to know that if they saw something that just didn't look right, make that call to 911. During the activation itself, we focused on local coordination, making sure we were plugged in with our local emergency management partners as well as our tribal emergency management partners that had activated emergency operations centers, maintaining situational awareness around infrastructure like energy, roads, communications, healthcare, airports, and the retail supply chain. And again, public information was key to this activation. Rumor control, messages about stable fuel supplies, traffic updates, concerns about eclipse safety glasses, and the availability of these glasses became big messaging components for our folks, and then reinforcing those key messages. All in all, we believe that the advanced messaging worked. For the most part, folks got where they wanted to go early. They stayed maybe not as long as we wish they would have, especially if you're stuck on Interstate 5 for any length of time on Eclipse Monday. But these also positioned us to be responsive to the wildfire coordination needs, including evacuations that actually occurred within the path of totality for the Millie Fire and the Nana Springs Fire, which included a shelter-in-place order for the Kaneda Resort, as well as a pretty serious wildfire down south, the Chetco Bar Fire, which required interstate coordination with the state of California. At the end of the day, over 5,000 Raptor page views were recorded. That's the real-time assistance and planning tool for Oregon situational awareness and GIS mapping platform. 5,000 page views per day. Typically, that has maybe 100, and probably 60 of those page views a day that it averages are my staff. On Friday, August 18th, after some media publicity, it had over 14,000 page views that day alone. The Oregon Eclipse, or OR Eclipse hashtag, recorded 24 million people reached in the 5 days leading up to the eclipse. And from 7 a.m. to noon on the day of the eclipse, 35 million people were reached by the OR Eclipse hashtag, and it was trending nationally. 2,200 eclipse-related calls were received by 211. That's the statewide information hotline, and over 5,000 visits to their eclipse-specific website. So again, our ability to share information and get information targeted to folks who needed it was impressive. Today, as a matter of fact, we began our formal after-action review process focusing on three areas: the planning process, the activation of the ECC, and the Joint Information Center. And we'll also incorporate any local, tribal, and state partner after-action reports and feedback as well. Ultimately, this was an incredibly positive and collaborative experience. The emergency management community was able to build on lessons from the Cascadia Rising exercise a year prior, practically apply our processes and training that often can only be honed in an artificial exercise environment or after a catastrophe, and evaluate some of the assumptions we have about how we'll operate in a large disaster. I look forward to sharing our after-action report when it's completed and continuing to find opportunities to continue doing what we do well and improving in areas where more work or resources may be needed. That's all for my prepared remarks. Thank you.
Thank you. If we can hold questions, I'd like the second presenter to go, and then some of your questions may actually go across disciplines. So, Mr. Devereaux?
Chair Evans, Vice Chair Boone, Vice Chair Esquivel, for the record, my name is M.G. Devereaux. I'm proud to be the Deputy Director for Oregon's Parks and Recreation Department. We had a unique opportunity to help the state of Oregon in a planned natural disaster that rolled over us in what we considered to be a five-day event, the 3 days before and the 2 days after the actual eclipse. As we knew that most visitors were coming to us in that time period to secure their spot, make sure they had everything that they needed, and then hopefully give themselves time to get back out onto the road. By almost all of our measures, it was a tremendous success for Oregon and Oregon State Parks. We served over 5,000 camping reservations with inside that 5 days, and 1,000 of those camping reservations were new sites that we created specifically for the general public to have additional access to look at the eclipse through the lens of being in an Oregon State Park. In addition to those 5,000 overnight visits or those overnight reservations, we also had thousands of folks scattered throughout the state from the Quinnahead, the State Capitol State Park, and Clyde Holiday State Park, all within the path of totality, looking for that opportunity to see that once-in-a-lifetime event. We were able to accomplish that with no significant incident in any of our state parks. I think we had one incident in eastern Oregon where a woman tripped and sprained her ankle mildly but was able to walk back to her campsite. We believe that was because of the planning that we did in cooperation with our other state agencies and with our other local partners. But quite frankly, we almost missed it. I remember taking a call 2 years ago from someone saying, hey, you need to shut down Highway 101, you need to shut down 97 because this is coming. And it was sort of a, what are you talking about? I had been here in the 70s when the last eclipse happened and thought, it's going to be 2 minutes. What do we need to worry about? About 8 months after that call, it sort of started to dawn us as we had people calling our reservation center, actually offering bribes to those folks who take reservations to open up the system early. And sort of the light bulb went off to us that this was going to be something that we were needed to take seriously, but also gave us a unique opportunity to plan for something that we knew the exact time and date of when something significant would happen in the agency history and be able to prepare for that in a manner that hopefully put our best foot forward and avoided disaster. We're just starting our after-action report as well, but the general themes that are emerging from the work that we're doing really follow three broad areas. We have identified opportunities for training and planning, capacity building through partnership, and resiliency modeling. What do each of those mean? Prior to the eclipse, much of our planning and resources was centered on local or smaller park scale issues, whether it was a wildfire in a park or a significant accident or injury or something that would have affected a local staff. The broadest approach that we had participated in was the Cascadia Rising, which again, because it has such a large magnitude and the potential for so much disruption, is difficult for us to talk with our local staff about how they might be involved playing scenario games. However, the eclipse eclipse planning gave us the opportunity to run specific scenario plannings in areas that we knew were going to be affected and identify some very key issues. Key issues like making sure that all staff throughout our chain of command and our volunteers knew what their roles and responsibilities were, and we were able to test out the assumptions if communications went down or there was a situation that they had not dealt with in a park before, how they would handle it in those situations. We were able to develop supply caches of needed information and equipment that was not only helpful for the eclipse, but we also anticipate will be helpful for other potential disasters, whether it's a large crowd management, its support to a local emergency, or if it's something larger like the Cascadia event. We were also able to think about how we can cross-train our staff and move them from location to help assist in larger events. We believe that this will be incredibly important if we have large events that completely wipe out, from a resource perspective, our staff in one location. We have staff that are cross-trained to go in behind those employees, give them a break, allow them the opportunity to go take care of their families and take care of the things that are close and important for them, as well as simplify our volunteer training. We relied on almost 300 new volunteers throughout the path of totality to help make sure that education programs ran, that traffic management programs that we had developed in coordination with ODOT and other agencies were implemented well. The second area in terms of capacity building really goes to a huge thanks to the team that we had inside of the agency that led this planning effort, as well as the coordination with OEM, ODOT, DHS, ODF, OSP, and all of our county and local officials. We were able to, inside the path of totality and on the edges, coordinate with the agencies that we needed to, find direct contacts, get familiar with the emergency management structure, and begin to set up our own agency operations center, which we had not done previously. This allowed us to have flexible solutions to problems as they came up and had the contacts that we needed to. One of those examples that I think we're most proud of is the notion that when the call came out to realize that we didn't want everybody back out on the highway immediately after the eclipse, we made the decision from a customer service standpoint to extend essentially a free night of stay to those visitors in the sites that we had created off of the reservation system in an effort to hopefully get them one more night, not get out on the highway. And in some cases, folks immediately took advantage of that. But in some cases, like the Cove Palisades, we had folks that tried to get from the Cove Palisades to Highway 97, and after a two-hour wait to get to 97, turned around and came back to the park knowing that they had a spot and knowing that we could provide an outstanding customer service opportunity for them. The final area that we've been looking at is the notion of resiliency modeling. And it's for us, that's the ability to recover from a significant event, which for the state park experience, while this was looked at from the lens of an emergency and the potential of a disaster, it was also an opportunity for us to inculcate from our staff a customer service mindset. We at our heart are a service organization to provide experiences to Oregonians and their visitors. And shortly after the eclipse, there was a holiday weekend that we needed to make sure that our staff was ready and prepared to turn around all of those sites, all of those parks, to make sure that we fulfilled the need for the reservations that were coming in. So the issues that we identified in our pre-planning and are currently continuing to evaluate in our after action allowed us to test out our responses and to come up with better and more flexible ways of doing our business to make sure that we could meet those needs. Whether those are evaluation of our rules to make sure that we had the right people making decisions at the right level, or whether it was opportunities for leadership development so that our line staff could be comfortable making command decisions when they needed to make those decisions to make sure that issues were resolved at the lowest level possible. We obviously think that there's room for improvement, as there are obviously ways that we can deploy our folks better in a real emergency that has other implications besides being planned, but we think that we've got a great step moving forward this and can look back at the eclipse as a wonderful moment of pride for Oregon and the visitors that we served.
Well, I want to start with saying thank you for a great preliminary report from both. I'm glad that the worst that we have to talk about is somebody spraining an ankle. Sometimes folks that do the proper planning never get the pass on the back because people don't know that all the little things that went into place to make sure that there wasn't anything to report that day. So thank you. I don't know if a million people came or not, but hopefully enough people came to Oregon that they want to come again and spend money and then go home and do so safely. And I think that your work certainly made a difference in that. Other questions? Yes, sir.
Thank you. And I want to echo, too, the thanks for all the efforts that went in and the lessons learned. So I was curious, as you talked about the coordination with parks, and specifically I'm thinking of county, because in many cases some of the county parks are closer in relationship to the state than communities. So, and I appreciate the efforts that went into the coordination. I'm trying to understand, though, what happened before this and what we learned from that that's going to ensure, because if I think about a Cascadia event or something, in some cases those locations of those parks and are going to be critical from a standpoint of accommodating housing or temporarily putting people. So I'm trying to understand, so what did we learn from this and what's in place now that if something else happens for that, especially with the counties, that coordination with those spaces?
Chair Evans, Representative Lively, I think for the parks standpoint specifically with coordination with counties, that happened at two levels. First, on the emergency management level, just how we deal with disasters. I think the eclipse allowed us a special opportunity to think about some of the things that would come into play in an after action and a recovery scenario. I think that the million people were here. I think that they got distributed in places that we had not anticipated that they would be. The decision from the city of Salem to open up their parks, many school districts at the last minute said, hey, come camp on our lawn. There were people here. Now, whether or not they traveled all at that same moment that we wanted to or that we expected them to, what that coordination showed was that there are ways that we can use the resources that we have in our communities that we don't necessarily think of them as recovery facilities. If it's large open space, if it's community meeting halls, if it's communication infrastructure that's there and in place that can be utilized and thought of ahead of time, I think from our perspective what that gave us was the notion that there are places to go in after a disaster, after a true emergency, that we can utilize in different ways that they're currently being utilized if we think about that ahead of time.
Thank you.
Phelps, you want to take a shot at that, or you don't have to, just offering?
Well, I would, Chair Evans, members of the committee, I would echo the flexibility, I think, that was displayed not just by our state agencies but also our local partners. Some of the in-the-field decision-making that folks may be hesitant to make on the fly, I think we did a good job of learning to empower and learning to trust people that are in that position on the ground to make decisions when something bad is happening or when something unexpected happens, and that level of trust that now exists. Certainly the partnerships we were able to build working with agencies that we typically don't get to interact with. Travel Oregon, for example, never had a planning meeting with Travel Oregon in my life.
There'll be a few more coming up.
I had many, many meetings with him, and it was fantastic. And you learn the skill sets that exist beyond just our own agencies. And I think we start to understand that everyone in state government really, when it comes down to it, is an emergency manager. Right. And I think that's an important lesson to learn.
Okay.
Did you have another?
Do you have a follow-up?
Thank you. I was just curious from a financial resources standpoint, given all of this and the coordination and what or didn't happen. So on the review, the view back, were there anything that we did not expect from a financial cost or that we had to do that if we, especially for planning for the future, we might want to have reserves or that? And I'm going to go back, part of it goes back to the counties and the other people involved with this that we learned or didn't learn, or did it all go as planned and we had all the resources that we needed?
Chair Evans, Representative Lively, I think I can speak to that at a high level. I know that, especially at the local level, a tremendous amount of funds were expended to ensure a safe and enjoyable event for mm-hmm. everyone that came to Oregon or the Oregonians that chose to view the eclipse. In terms of a dollar amount, it'd be hard at this point to put a finger on it, but I know several state agencies entered into contractual agreements to bring in additional life safety resources to bear. We're not resourced. I don't think any state agency is resourced to do the type of response that we would expect for a Cascadia subduction zone earthquake. I think this was a very small example of what we would be expecting in that type of an event. Speaking for OEM, the amount of staff we needed to bring in and the hours worked far exceeded what we had anticipated. That was due in large part to the wildfires. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I would say that this event certainly will come at a cost.
Sure.
Mr. Dever?
Chair Evans, Representative Lively. Yeah, I think we would echo those sentiments. For us, again, because this was largely a customer service event, we brought the staff on that we thought we would need to handle those visitors in a real emergency. We wouldn't be prepositioning porta potties, so we wouldn't have some of those costs, but we know that it's going to take resources, and this event took resources as well to make sure that we put the best foot forward.
Thank you.
So I'm going to ask a rhetorical question before I hand it off to Representative Parrish, but since you mentioned sanitary services, would it be your opinion that knowing now the value of those facilities, that if there was a way to have at least pre-designation of some of those parks with sewer, water, transportation, communications, and space designed for temporary structures, that would be seen as a value?
Chair Evans, I think that's one of the things that we've been looking at in our Cascadia planning in terms of where we have resources currently and what resources could be improved, both in the subduction zone but also behind those resources, to make sure that from our staffing standpoint but also from coordination with OEM, what that recovery would look like. If we knew where those resources were, certainly if it was helpful in an event like this or a large community event, but also available for disaster recovery, it's something that I think we'd be interested in exploring.
I'd like to formally invite you to the Open Spaces work group that we're working on. Representative Parrish.
Chair likes work groups and task force. Well, first of all, I want to thank you both for the work. Ultimately, other than the lines of traffic on I-5 after the event, we just really didn't hear a lot of, you know, emergency stuff that came out of this with the sheer volume of extra people in the state. And I just think that the everyday citizen probably has no idea the level of coordination and all of the sort of interagency discussion that happened. So I just want to thank you both for that. I am also going to jump ahead to the next hearing because Mr. Dever won't be on that panel, but I want to also publicly thank you for the call that you took from me on a Friday afternoon shortly after the eclipse, where we had firefighters who were struggling to not be bumped out of camping facilities. So when they're traveling and they bring their RV and they bring their family, and you know, and we have a camping policy that says 14 days. About 3 o'clock on a Friday, said, "Can we fix that? So these guys aren't coming off the fire lines in the middle of the night and trying to move RVs into new spaces because they were, you know, being told to leave." And it was fixed within an hour at the state level. We're having a little bit of challenges at the county level because I've been making those calls to counties for folks that did not get bumped off of campsites.
Hours pretty fast.
Yeah.
But it was, and I want to appreciate just to say it. And actually, it was Representative Hayden called and said, "We're getting bumped out of these parks because we've been here for 14 days.
Well, if you're bumping Hayden, that's okay."
Well, bumping all of these guys, essentially.
The firefighters,
and,
I get your point.
And so, you know, so that will actually probably lead into a priority bill for me to address that permanently at all levels of taxpayer funding. When we have fires, we don't bump firefighters and the people that are out there doing that. But I just really appreciate it because your agency dealt with that within, like I said, within an hour, and it was solved and it was communicated out to folks. And I just think that is probably a good byproduct of everything you've just been through, to then convert that and say, okay, well, we also have these resources and people are using them for the fires as well. And so I just really wanted to thank you publicly for that. It was awesome.
I'm going to take the chair's liberty at this point because we're on time, and that was a good way to end. Thank you both for the work that you did. And please tell your troops thanks for all the work to make sure that most people, all I ever saw was a traffic jam on TV.
That's right.
And I guess an ankle injury. It could have been a whole lot worse, and I truly appreciate, because I know the kind of planning necessary to pull something like that off. So thank you very much. Have a great rest of your day. And we're going to be moving on in the agenda. We're going to be wildfire efforts. We invite up State Fire Marshal Jim Walker, Doug Raffey, and Deputy Director Dave Stuckey. Please come on up. And excuse me, Mr. Graffy, I don't know your title, but I assume you're with the Forestry Department.
Chief of Fire Protection, ODF.
Chief, all right, there we go. All yours. And actually, no, it's not. Before you begin, focus today is on the response. We're not talking about the policies about how we got from here to there. We're not talking about what caused fires. That's for different policy committees, and that's why I have this here today. The discussion today is, you guys are out there trying to send folks in to put the fire out. What do you need? How's it going? And what can we do to make sure your response capacities are better? The rest is a different policy issue.
Okay.
I think we just had this discussion in the prior committee.
Yeah.
Chair Evans, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Doug Graff. I serve as Chief of Fire Protection, Oregon Department of Forestry. I appreciate the opportunity and your interest in this topic, and I really, truly appreciate the two individuals next to me. We've spoken quite a bit this summer, been daily briefing, and I think I've talked to these folks more than I've talked to my family in the last couple months. And,
still smiling, so that's good.
I'll give a high-level briefing so we paint the picture on the conditions that we had on the fire season this year. I'll turn to Chief Walker for a couple comments as I hit the Eagle Creek and Chetco Bar fires, and then we'll close with Deputy Great. Director Stuckey.
Thank you.
So to start with, wildfire impacts everybody, and clearly I think this year will be remembered in many ways with the smoke impacts, significant fire seasons, significant smoke conditions across the state, 1,903 fires to date across all jurisdictions within the state of Oregon. We've burned 678,000 acres across Oregon, and total cost for fire suppression has been $340 million across all jurisdictions within the state of Oregon. I'll speak specifically, I see the cringing, on the state's responsibility through ODF fire protection.
I want to be clear that these fires, they're not our fires.
Not
they're
all
nature's
us.
Fires, yeah.
To be clear. So I'll highlight the ODF responsibility. We protect 16 million acres of fire protection in the state of Oregon. So a significant year. This day, September 4th, was pretty consistent with several days that we've experienced across the state. Really, mid-August is when we started seeing some of these significant smoke conditions across the landscape. On the 4th, we had an additional 14,000 acres of growth on existing fires within Oregon and Washington. The next day, we had 50,000 acres of growth across that same landscape. On the 6th, we had 96,000 acres of fire growth on existing fires across the landscape. And on the 7th, 69,000 acres. To give you some perspective of where the smoke came from, why it exists, you can see the fires in red here across the landscape, Chetco Bar to the far south, Eagle Creek there in the Portland border. And, of course, Idaho had some significant fires that were sharing smoke our direction depending on the weather conditions of the day. So one of the questions is, what's the key drivers? We always look at lightning. Certainly it plays a key part in every fire season. This looks at 6-1 to current in terms of number of lightning strikes, 37,000 lightning strikes across the state during this period. But you see the lethal lightning strikes start to begin late in July, early August, really hot, dry conditions that really started mid-June and carried forward. No substantial rain up until this day and yesterday, which very excited about. But, you know, the continued drying conditions, so coupled with those drying conditions and then the lightning, which was consistent. We don't necessarily see this consistency every year. In fact, on ODF protection, we had 67 fires lightning caused in all of last fire season. We had 276 lightning fires this year. So every year poses different challenges for us. You can see the numbers of fires that started from this event. So I would suggest that coupled those two factors, lightning and the continued drying, key drivers in this year's fire season. Speaking to ODF's responsibility on the 16 million acres private land and public land, we protect approximately 12 million acres of private land, 4 million acres of public land, majority there the BLM contract, 2.4 million acres. We're seeing 42,000 acres on ODF protected lands. So much different than the 680,000. And then, of course, cost is consistent there. Gross costs. This is a 10-year average here, but this 2017 was sitting at $37 million gross cost. Net of FEMA recoveries and other agency billings, we're sitting at $31.5 million. So a little breath there from the $340 million I highlighted.
Little breath.
Still
a lot.
Still a lot, no doubt.
What does the fire landscape look like? These are current fires across the landscape. And if I showed you this picture a month and a half ago, we'd see a lot more fire on the east side. Did a really good job. We were really challenged in June, July on the east side, able to hold a lot of those fires to a minimal size, and we don't see them on the landscape. But a lot of these western fires really defines this fire season, the smoke impacts. A lot of these fires here, and you can see by the green designation, these are up in the high country on Forest Service ground. And then the two fires, Flounce Fire and Horse Prairie. I have a slide specifically on Horse Prairie. That's completely our jurisdiction in the BLM and private land checkerboard in southwest Oregon, and I'll highlight that specifically. But a few numbers to give you some perspective as you look at the west side of the Cascade Rim there. The Whitewater Fire to the north, 13,000 acres just to the east. Millie Fire at 24,000 acres. Horse Creek Complex, which is this grouping of fires, 31,000 acres. The Jones Fire just to the west, 9,000 acres. Rebel Fire just to the south, 8,000 acres. These are current acreages on these fires. The next slide, just a different look on the map to show. I wanted to make a distinction for you on our briefing maps and our operational maps. This is satellite imagery that shows heat on the landscape, and it gives you a real perspective of how much fire all those thousands of acres look like and accumulated across the landscape. Much of the Umpqua and the North Umpqua and the Siskiyous had fire on the landscape deep in the Forest Service ground. ODF protection in Southwest is this checkerboard between the private lands in white and the BLM contracted lands in much of the Southwest. So a real interesting landscape. And this is our briefing maps that provide a little bit more detail. I'll touch on the Horse Prairie fire with some specificity. This map is what we call a progression map. So you can look at the start of the fire and then throughout the life of the fire, how it moved. This one was under a smoke inversion for most of the time. Very difficult fire to contain, however, even with that smoke inversion, limited aviation assets ability to use that and see through the smoke. But we did a fairly good job on this one. This isn't the same timing, the same weather conditions, landscape conditions, fuel conditions as a Stouts Creek fire in 2015, Douglas Complex 2013. Those are large fires. I thought I would never say this was a great catch at 16,000 acres, but this was a great catch at 16,000 acres. $16 million exposure to the state on this fire, so that's about half. So we're real close to, you know, cutting that with half with one less large fire on the landscape. So really a shame, and I suspect that this is a human-caused fire. This detail, the briefing map, shows the checkerboard again. And I think to highlight on this fire, I would recognize at the foundation of how the department does business, we leverage our partnerships. And you saw this in a big way with the landowner response on this fire. Over 70 pieces of equipment, heavy equipment, line construction, immediately available to the department from the forest landowners that we protect. It's truly a partnership. They showed up on the line on day one and helped us establish 38 miles of containment lines on this fire. So excellent coordination. The Chetco Bar Fire, this is a progression map again, so it gives you some exposure of, you know, what this fire did over the course of the month and a half that it was on the landscape, and really started on July 12th back here in the green and made a big move from the 17th to the 21st. And I'll highlight the numbers. Acreage on the 17th was 8,500 here in the green before it jumped the Chetco River. We had a Chetco effect wind. It's a localized wind. If you're from Southern California, you know these winds as the Santa Ana winds. In Oregon, they're the Chetco winds for this part of the country. So similar effect, though. 8,500 acres first day on the 17th, 14,000 the next day, 26,000 the next day, 7 mile run, jumped it to 70,000 acres. That's a 44,000 acre growth in one day, and then 91,000 the final day on August 21st, which was the eclipse day, and the wind subsided. So that was truly wind-driven. And then we really attacked the head of this fire, really concerned about the flanks, and we were certainly getting outflanked by this fire, as you can see. But we took this head on with great coordination. And with that coordination, I think I'll turn it over to Mr. Walker for any details on this fire.
I'm Chair Evans, committee members. For the record, my name is Jim Walker, Oregon State Fire Marshal with the Office of State Fire Marshal. And we've listened a little bit about the solar eclipse and all the planning that went into play for the solar eclipse. And so some of the things we had talked about in getting ready for that and preparing for that was really that EMAC process and what would happen if we did need additional resources. And that really played into this fire, because as we were looking at what resources were available, we had pre-planned out the path of totality. And everywhere along that path of totality, if something was to occur, then where would those resources come from? Because we knew that there could be potentially congestion and other things that would keep the response from being able to get there. So we had pre-planned out all of these resources that we knew were available to respond. And to be honest with you, there weren't an awful lot of them, because there was an awful lot of other things that were going on in the state as well. You had the Willamette Country Music Festival, and usually we get a lot of resources from that part of the state. And then plus those folks that were really reluctant to send resources until they knew, really knew what they were going to see with the solar eclipse. So this happened prior to the solar eclipse, although I was in Brookings when it originally exploded. At about 1 p.m. that day, the town was completely blacked out and all the street lights were on, and that was our solar eclipse. I understand it wasn't as beautiful as the real thing, but that's what we got to see. But because we had all that pre-planning in place, we were able to mobilize resources quickly, and we were also able to utilize the EMAC process to get three task forces from California as well. ODF had pre-positioned some resources under severity to help just in case, and they had two task forces from Washington. So we were able to bring those to bear, along with all of the Oregon task forces that did come. And the fire service really stepped up, because although a lot of them said we probably won't be available, when they saw the severity of this incident and the impact that it was having on Brookings, they responded. And they responded in force. On one given day, on that incident, we had 333 firefighters. And that would make us then the largest on-duty fire department in the state of Oregon. And they were there. And it was communities protecting communities. It was from fire departments from all over the state that responded at that time. There were over 12,286 structures threatened. And when you take a look at the size of this fire, and like Doug mentioned, you know, really we took a stand on that south-southwest corner. But we had communities on the Pistol River that were threatened, the Checo that were threatened, this community of Brookings that was threatened, the Windchuck that was threatened, and eventually Illinois Valley and Cave Junction that were threatened. And so when they start talking about 188,000 acres, remembering that, you know, one square mile is 640 acres, that's a pretty significant area that you're trying to defend. At that same time, over 5,196 folks were evacuated from their homes. They were told, you just need to get out, and you need to get out now. We did have 21 task forces assigned to that incident, and remembering that five engines make up a task force, so that's a significant. Some of those engines have five personnel on them. Some have three. Some have two. Again, 75 Oregon fire agencies responded, 16 Washington fire agencies, and then 19 California fire agencies. And then we did have one individual that we also got from the Oregon Department of Forestry and a mid-level management position, which were really hard to come by because of everything that was else was going on, from North Carolina. So it really was a coordinated effort.
North Carolina sent one guy.
They sent about 50 overhead.
We just got one. Overhead.
Okay.
That one was key to them on their incident management team specifically.
I just didn't know if they were still mad about a certain World Series of college baseball or something.
Yeah, sorry. No. They were actually great, but it was really difficult to find resources. And so having the relationships that we do with the Department of Forestry and their ability to get resources, and then our relationship with the fire service and able to get resources, paid dividends on that incident. Did lose six residences, and our goal is to you know, zero is what we look at. But again, when you look at the number of homes that were in there, how they spread out up through the Checo drainage, beautiful places and beautiful spots, but I mean, that's all timber.
Build and dump places.
All timber. We did prep 1,239 homes, so we actually went in, and as we were anticipating this thing moving forward, they went in, and you know, usually firefighters order up hoses and nozzles and pumps, and in this case, we were using leaf blowers, we were using weed eaters, and so they were able to get up on the roofs and blow off all the debris, clear the gutters, and prep the homes for in case this thing did come into the community. And like Doug was telling you, this thing was moving fairly rapidly into those communities. We also triaged a number of homes as well. Brookings is probably pretty close to now being a FireWise community, thanks to all of the work that the firefighters did. They also sprinklered 174 homes, which is a significant task to do, to come in and set up porta tanks, pumps, hose, and then position these sprinklers around there. So a lot of those are roads that are one way in and one way out, and it's not really safe for the firefighters to stay in there and fight it. So what they'll do is they set that up, and then they've got a management point or decision-making point. When they make that decision, they flip a switch, turn on the pump, and then they get out, because obviously firefighter safety is our number one priority. But again, that was a significant challenge because it came off, you know, it was on a lot of federal grounds that do not have roads and road accesses, and so we had to just kind of wait for it to get to the communities and kind of make our stands when it did get there. So thanks.
Moving on to the Eagle Creek fire, this is one of the other most significant fires we experienced this year. This is, again, our situational map that we use for briefing with the intelligence on the heat sensors. You can see along the Cascade Locks community, we did a burnout here to protect and hold that line against that community very successfully into the evenings. That fire did want to push to the east here on 915, and it did want to run up the canyons, very difficult ground, tough to get people into this ground. And it also wanted to push here to the south throughout the course of the fire. And this, of course, is the Bull Run watershed to the south. And as of today, no fire in the Bull Run watershed, so very successful there, and I think we're in a good place, obviously, with the rain and the conditions we're at here. The progression map shows you the intensity fire movement. Started on the 2nd. We had the Indian Creek fire here on the landscape already, and that was in place 7-4. Then on September 2nd, the Eagle Creek fire stats made a 2,000-acre run that first afternoon. We had entrapment of 153 hikers that evening and got those folks out safely the next day. After that day, that we had the fire blew up the next morning. That's clearly a wind-driven fire. Very long run, 13 miles in one afternoon and one evening, over 16 hours. So that's close to a mile an hour through some very difficult country, spotting ahead of itself, and of course spotting across the Columbia River Gorge, the river under the Washington side. Then the following day, you can see it just consumed the tough country here up in the canyonlands, and then made another push to the east. Jim, was there anything you wanted to add to this fire?
Yeah, just real quickly on this one. Got back from the Checo Bar fire and then was blessed with the opportunity to go to the Eagle Creek fire when it was blowing up. And I mean blessed because of the work that was done that night by the Structural Fire Service as well as the Wildland Fire community. What they ended up having to do was just go to point protection. So a lot of what this fire was doing was spotting out ahead of itself within communities, and they were just having to go after it and catch it. And they did that hand in hand with all of the resources partnering together. Again, 5,230 structures were threatened. 1,822 people evacuated, all of Cascade Locks, for a good period of time. We had 28 task forces, so we had broken the record for the most task forces we'd ever had out on an incident on the Checo Bar, and not more than, you know, a few days later we did so on this one. And you can see, because there's a lot of communities that were threatened along that path. One thing I did get to witness is that most of our engines that we use are engines that not only protect homes, but they're able to move around in the urban interface, so they're very mobile. So you won't see a ladder truck out there like you do in your larger cities or your communities with high rises. And in this case, you probably have seen a number of photos of a ladder truck there at the Multnomah Lodge. And I do have to say that when the order of the request came in, it was the darndest thing you know, that I had heard of, is that, you know, actually utilizing one of those resources. And what happened there was that all of that debris that was falling off the backside of the falls, nobody could get behind it and safely get in there to protect it. And so what they were able to use is that ladder truck with a number of water tenders supporting it to reach up over the top. And if you take a look at the photos, it basically came within about 40 feet of the lodge and that close to actually burning the lodge down. And without that ladder truck and its ability to get in there and do what it did, we would have mostly liked that lodge. There are also a couple other communities with a number of homes where the firefighters went in and made some stands. And so, again, very, very impressed with the task forces that we've seen this year. You know, we've had a lot of conflagrations over the last probably 4 or 5 years, and you don't want to necessarily get really good at doing this, but I'd have to say some of the task forces that we're seeing right now are some of the best that you'll see in the country. And the other thing I do want to point out is you don't want to be number one on these fires, right? If you're the number one fire in the nation or the number one incident in the nation, that means things aren't going extremely well. And the Checo Bar fire at one time was the number one fire in the nation, and the Eagle Creek fire was the number one fire in the nation. And so your resources that come from your area that you support in your local areas that came to these responses did so in some of the toughest terrain, toughest conditions, and did so very successfully.
So I have two questions, and there may not be time today to answer them, but there are questions that when you have a chance to catch your breath, I'm curious about. The first is, you mentioned something earlier about the reluctance of some people to send resources. At a later date, I'd like to understand what that exactly means, because in the middle of a disaster, reluctance isn't an acceptable term if you need the resources to save life and property. The second issue is, as we are looking at, through a grant process called Unleash, providing equipment that is theoretically usable around the state as disasters advance, is there a need or would there be a value of equipment that you found now through two very expansive experiences that a cachet of additional water tenders, brush rigs, et cetera, that standardized across, that as you're throwing folks and equipment at, if you have multiple fires going on and people are reluctant to send their equipment, at least a baseline reserve that you guys could use that would be interoperable? Is there a value of that? Do you have the equipment you need, or are we now in an era where there's anticipated enough fires that having a reserve fleet of equipment might be necessary instead of pulling out of fire districts and putting them on the road?
Yeah, Chair Evans, I think it's a good topic, and we can definitely have some good discussions on it, because I know California does that. Where the state actually buys the resource, and then it's staffed by the local fire departments in their case. Cautious on the reluctant piece, because what I was really looking at, some of those smaller departments, you know, they only have a small handful of folks, and their concerns was being able to respond to emergencies in their communities during that solar eclipse because of everything that was there.
Okay.
But again, at that same time, when the call did come out, I was extremely impressed and extremely surprised at how many, like I said, did send resources even during that time. It's just a challenge to leave your own community, possibly.
I get it.
Yeah, very good. Continue. Do you want me to answer that question?
Is there equipment that would be of use for both?
Yeah,
I know you fight fires a little differently than the structural guys do.
We do,
but in terms of certain types of equipment that could be standardized, if there's a value added for a reserve fleet of some type, that would be a good time to say.
As I highlighted, the landowner engagement with equipment really brings to bear a tremendous resource there. Where we found our bottlenecks and pinch points in this year and previous years is critical intermediate overhead leadership, so single resource boss, task force leaders, division supervisors, so qualified firefighters. We run out of those nationally as you put this much fire on the landscape. We had 8,000 people fighting fire in Oregon at our peak, 25,000 individuals fighting fire across the nation. So we'll be looking to ask, how do we build that capacity? And one example that we've operated in the past, I'd say 5 to 10 years, we've leaned on, again, landowner patent is to work and become qualified as single resource bosses. So before they would bring the equipment, and then we would bring the overhead leadership to manage that. Now they're bringing the overhead leadership, and I would look to my patent and deputy director military is that's where we need to go with crews. That's our next step in evolution in this process, to be ready with resources to invest in their ability to train leadership overhead. So we're not going nationally to try to find that overhead.
And as Deputy Director Stuckey, I assume, is going to talk next.
I will, yeah.
One of the pieces that I'm hoping to hear about also is 7-8 years ago, we looked at EMAC, and we looked at there was a glitch that either it was reimbursement or it was insurance coverage, one of the two. I can't remember which one it was. People were from outside the state were reluctant to come into Oregon because the coverage wasn't the same as it was in California, Washington, and other places. I had been told that had been fixed, and if it is, great. If it's not, was that a significant deterrent to prevent people from coming in when we needed them? That's just an area of, since we've had these two, I want to know if that worked or didn't work.
Chair Evans, members of the committee, I'm Dave Stuckey, Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department, and thank you for the opportunity to answer that question. As Mr. Graff mentions, crew bosses is one of the key components to this, and I'll talk a little bit later, but when the National Guard crew fire teams get deployed, it's a crew of 20 people, but we need someone smart to lead them. They're great at warfighting skills. They're great at some of their civilian acquired skills, but they're not firefighters. They're not wildland firefighters. And it takes a wildland firefighter expert to kind of lead that crew. And so that's really what Mr. Graff is getting to is that crew boss component. We throw in every asset we have on the guard side because we have our own wildland fire department because we have to manage our training posts. We have training areas. And if we catch a fire out there in Umatilla, Redmond, Camp Raleigh, wherever that may be, we have to put those fires out. So we throw those crew bosses in, but that's less than 10 out there. And so what Mr. Graff is mentioning is there's a couple of different nexuses. There's the state side where looking for that investment to try and train guardsmen up front to be able to deploy at a moment's notice. And then there's also the federal side, and Major General Stencil has worked really hard on the congressional side with at least one or two senators to try and force that mechanism to say, okay, DHS, FEMA, pony up some money. Go ahead and give it to NGB. Then let NGB divvy that out to the western states. And so that initiative is also out there. It's not new, but it's one of those things that we're going to continue to peck away at, and hopefully we can try and get some effort on.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think there's a missing piece here as well that's changed in the last 30 years, and that is we used to have a readily available firefighting group, and that was the loggers because they had the equipment there. They could do the roads. They could bring the fire. And in fact, they stood right on the job and did it. We've lost that, and that's unfortunate because those were an asset to us at the time.
Right. And Chair Evans and Representative Escobar, the other piece and defer to the Oregon State Fire Marshal is PNEMA. It really becomes that tool that he uses to get adjacent state support from. And so we shy away from EMAC, and this is more the Director Phelps arena, and this is his lane, to help facilitate that PNEMA discussion with Washington, California, to get those structural fire assets in there. Because Andrew's in his hands are in every little pot that we have out there in emergency management. That's exactly where we want him. And so he's there for EMAC and bringing in assets from California for Eclipse, or we have a Washington Guard Blackhawk that's out supporting one of our fires. And so when we're short or they're short, we go to Andrew and say, start resourcing it, buddy.
Okay, continuing on with the briefing, I do want to close with this slide, which highlights and recognizes clearly that this is a partnership, a complete and coordinated fire protection system for the state of Oregon that works. We partner well and leverage all the partners there. And as I started on the first slide, this is an issue for all Oregonians. I'm very proud of the system we have in place, very proud of the partnership I have at this table, and those not represented necessarily at the table. Wanted to highlight in the bottom left here, ODOT has been a key player, opened the westbound lanes of 84, but this is the challenge, some of the challenge that they have, trees coming down off of those high ridge slopes and sliding into that eastbound highway, need to mitigate those hazards before that's fully opened. We'll highlight the the air resources from National Guard and the troops. I know when they left the training center, they looked a lot different than that. This is the logging equipment and operators who responded to Horse Prairie, U.S. Forest Service hotshot crew that hiked in to help the 153 standard hikers in between the Eagle Creek and Indian Creek fires, and of course a structure effort that you've noted there. And with that, I want to turn to Deputy Director Stuckey or Jim Walker if you had anything else to add. No?
Just Chair Evans, members of the committee, again, I'm Dave Stuckey, Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. Just a couple of things I'd like to highlight here in the Guard's role, a couple of key pieces here, and I'll be brief as possible. Certainly appreciate everything that Oregon Department of Forestry has done. What we do in the Oregon Military Department in order to support ODF is what we have is called Op Plan Smokey or Operational Plan Smokey. Chair Evans, this thing's been around forever, and it works. And so we don't want to mess it up. This is basically an agreement between us and ODF that says, here's the menu of stuff that you can bring in from the National Guard in case of emergency. In this particular case, it's initiated by a state declaration. Our governor declared early back on the 2nd of August, and then we had Chinooks out flying the next day, and then on his fires 2 days after that. And so it's a great component to be able to explain state active duty, which is basically for a guardsman, a guard person. It's putting them on a temporary state employee type of status. And so they go from Title 32 to state active duty, and they become a state employee. And so that's what kind of initiates it. The menu of stuff that exists for the Oregon Military Department to support ODF is basically in three types of capabilities. First is aviation, and you see it. The H-860 Black Hawk that goes out there, it does search and rescue on Mount Hood and other places through the course of the year, but then that's one of the first things they call for the medevac piece. Mr. Walker mentioned that these areas are not a lot of roads, steep terrain. You need that medevac, and we have a hoist capability. And so that's the first thing that gets called forward. And then the CH-47s is the next one. Quick rated R version of Cadence. You must be 18 in order. Where's the word? Must be 18 to participate in these events. CH-47 in the background and the second one flying. What you see there is a bandy bucket that's 2,000 gallons of water. Very extensive air coordination measures that there's no one on the ground if it's initial. 2,000 gallons on top of a firefighter's head. So that is the CH-47s. Happy to note that they're coming home tomorrow. ODF has finally released them since 3 August. We're thinking that they're going to keep them, but then fortunately they're going to give them back to us, which is a good thing. CH-47s are a great capability. Dual rotors. Those boys have been out there for a long time and they're in some hazardous conditions. And quite frankly, flying in wildland firefighting is as tough, if not tougher, than combat. and the experienced firefighter or pilot and with the CH-47s will explain, you know, there's different stresses, but at the same time, you're going full throttle because you got a lot of weight hauling that 2,000 gallons. You're trying to keep a tempo going because you got civilians behind you. You may have civilian helicopters in front of you, and you want to keep those turns going in order to make certain that you can drop as much fire on as possible. And then you got smoke. You got all these other hazards going on out there. It's pretty strenuous, but they're doing a great job out there. And so, as Mr. Graff mentioned in previous, we're up to 1.3 million gallons dropped in water this fire season. The last thing, the last medevac, the last Army helicopter that we've tapped into, or ODF's tapped into, is the UH-72 Lakota, and they do a lot of thermal imagery. This is a little small passenger, five-passenger aircraft, but we stick an ODF representative on the bird, and they're able to thermal image that fire, make certain they figure out exactly where the problems are, and then they can more precisely attack that. And so the helicopters is a big piece. They usually call for them early. They want to keep them a long time, and we're certainly there to help support them, and General Stencil loves to see that support go to ODF. The second capability that you hear about is the fire crews. The fire crews, we've actually activated five different fire crews this season. It's 125-person teams. It's six crews of 20. They add a crew boss for each 20, and then we have a small command and control support element of five that goes over the top of those six. And they've deployed throughout the course of the summer. And
Oregon National Guard service members from across the state are answering the call for help, both here at home and in support of other disasters in our nation. More than 500 Oregon National Guard airmen and soldiers, 63 of them from the 173rd Fighter Wing, are working alongside local, state, and federal agencies to fight fires across southern Oregon. Here at the Horse Prairie Fire, about 8 miles south of Camas Valley, a joint team of 173rd and 142nd Fighter Wing airmen and soldiers from the Oregon Army National Guard hold the line against a fire that has grown to more than 7,000 acres in size. They use water hoses to spray down hot areas and keep the flames from growing, and pickaxes and shovels to put out small smoldering fires in the ground. Their goal? To keep the fire from jumping across the boundary to the untouched forest land behind them. Reporting for the 173rd Fighter Wing, this is Technical Sergeant Jason Van Morick.
So we've been happy to be out there to support. We have typically to train to get out there, it takes a red card or a firefighter 2 training, which is generally 5 days of training. DPSST compacts it to 4 days, and I'd like to give a shout out to one of our partners. DPSST and Director Gablitz has been there every single opportunity we have. I don't think I've ever talked to him between 8 and 5 this whole summer. Just like Doug Graff, it's either on weekends because that's when he's calling, or the training is occurring on that weekend, and so he and his staff have gone into overtime to house us, to feed us, to train us, to get our PPE, the yellow shirts, the green pants, and they've been phenomenal in helping prepare our guard personnel to get out there on those fires. Third capability that I just like to highlight is it's everything else. We got trucks, we got generators, we have mobile kitchen units, we have all kinds of other stuff. This particular year, it happened to be traffic assistance points, and as you may have seen, it was actually the day before the eclipse on the 20th of August. The sheriff in Curry County was struggling with some traffic assistance issues, and so we had the ability to redirect some of our security force squadron personnel out of the 173rd out of Kingsley over to his location to help with traffic assistance. High Point aggregate, we are about 101 traffic assistance teams out there, and that's 24/7, about 20 plus locations for the last month or so. And so that's been a great opportunity to help both the sheriff as well as the incident command. So just the final stats, aviation, multiple helicopters, Washington, as well as within the state, 52 personnel, 70 sorties, 688 drops, over 1.3 million gallons. Firefighting, 785 guard personnel were trained, and all of them will be firefighter 2 red card trained for next year. So they'll already be available, so it'll be a quicker trigger if needed, quicker deployment time onto the fire if ODF so desires. And then, of course, the CHETCO traffic assistance points. So the summer's been busy. Besides our normal National Guard training, our events, our annual trainings, our exercises, we We've also deployed airmen to Texas for Harvey, as well as Florida for Irma. So we sent the 125th Special Tactics Squadron, they're the snake eaters of the Air Force, down to help support reestablishing the airheads to get supplies in to help those affected jurisdictions and help the people in those particular states. And so that was very, very positive. To date, we're at about 950 National Guard personnel on state active duty. That's a high since 2005 when we had Katrina and we deployed a brigade down to New Orleans. And so with that, I'd like to close and be happy to answer any questions.
Go ahead. Yeah, with your Chinooks, I don't know how many you have, but let's say that we had thermal imaging on those, and when a lightning strike happened, they could immediately go to the area where it's at and see if there's any indication of any heat source, and then use the bucket to do it, because I don't know how much 2,000 gallons would do, but I imagine it'd do a quarter of an acre, wouldn't it? Half an acre?
Yeah, so what you're referencing, Chair
it
Evans?
It doesn't matter the terrain, I don't think, if you go walk
yeah.
on it.
Yeah, absolutely. What you're referencing is initial attack strategies, and there's no doubt in my mind, early detection, immediate response, aggressive initial attack, minimizes acres, minimizes cost, minimizes resource loss, and that's what we're about. Currently, we use detection cameras that have been very effective across much of the western Oregon, and we're moving to central Oregon, establishing several detection cameras. They're able to pinpoint those fire stats with GPS coordinates, where before we used people in towers and had to three folks and coordinating. Then that data is delivered immediately to our aviation assets, many of which were made available from the Wildfire Protection Act 2013. Which is excellent legislation in terms of focusing on initial attack to minimize those acre size. And we bolstered our aviation assets to 17 aviation assets. So that data is immediately transmitted to the aviation assets and the ground forces, because that's what ultimately puts a fire out, someone at the end of a shovel. So that's coordinated. We do bring on additional assets, like the Lakota, as the deputy director mentioned, for specific infrared. Colorado made investment in an aircraft that we've had in 2015. We couldn't get it over this year, but we're using other technologies for immediate infrared downloads to the firefighters on the ground. Multi-mission aviation assets from Colorado. We've used we've piloted two projects this year with unmanned aerial, the drones, and one on Eagle and then one on Horse Prairie, which was very effective. And then we've used FLIR data. So you're speaking, the data you're referring to, we have touched that in different places, specifically to initial attack. Helicopter, I would highlight that would be helpful during the smoke conditions that we experienced this year, because what we're basing our aviation assets on is the visibility of those fires. Typically, we see initial attack fires. We can see them. You put a bird up in the air, we can find it pretty quick. The camera's pointing us. This year, we were struggled at Horse Prairie because the cameras couldn't detect it, and then the aviation asset, mainly our contracted ships, didn't have those assets, so that's a good point.
Well, we have thermal imaging in our fire department. Each one has a camera. Yeah. And if you walked across this rug, put that on, you could see your footsteps. It's that sensitive.
Yep.
So, I mean, that would be a great tool. And if we're going to send people out to do a first-class job, we need to support them with the proper equipment to do the first-class job, or we can't ask for it. So, my two cents.
Yes.
I was just curious as to any injuries, or there's got to be some, I mean, bee stings and things like that, but are there very many, or is it
yes.
out of all those people?
Chair Evans, Rep. Boone. I can speak to ODF's exposure this year. Significant hours. Every time as fires get large, that increase exposure hours. And that's another reason why aggressive initial attack makes really good sense. And we had significant exposure hours this year. Our injuries, interestingly, are lower than our 10-year average this year, but I would describe them as more dramatic and more serious. So we have some concerns on those. We had a rollover earlier on a fire. We've had three totaled engines with incidents on engines. So typically we get the sprains, the cuts, the bruises, the poison oak, but we've had some significant ones.
But no fatalities.
But no fatalities, thank you. In 2013, we did have fatality on an ODF fire, no fatalities this year. But 10 national.
Chair Evans, Representative Boone, we've had 38 injuries. 34 of them we have paperwork on. Of those 34, we're chasing the other four. We'll get them. We get the report. We'll get the 801 paper. We live on the paper. And we've had a couple of fractures, which are of concern. The rest are just sickness and injury, that soft tissue stuff that hopefully that airman or soldier can recover properly.
Thank you. I just have two quick questions. Who out of the group here was responsible for managing the smoke? that's what I thought. But so the question is, since it was severe this year, and I lived through field burning in the valley, and this was worse than any field burning in the valley. So was it the number of fires, was it wind conditions, or what really created the calamity of the smoke that set in the valley so long versus other large fire seasons?
Chair Evans, Rep. Lively, I'll speak to the smoke. The sheer volume and number of size of fires all at the same time, and I highlighted those continuous days of growth actively up through Washington because that impacts Oregon. And then I showed the Idaho fires. So in the Northern Rockies, significant fire this year across the landscape. We were in what's called a preparedness level 5, which is the highest level of preparedness level nationally and within the region for 37 days. That's record-breaking. So what that means is a lot of fire on the landscape nationally. Early on in the season, British Columbia burned in a significant way. They, at one point, they had 200 aviation assets, helicopters deployed at one time while they were fighting fires, and that smoke came down to us. So it was a combination of all those factors collectively across the course of this fire season that really challenged us. A lot of the fire was situated in the southwest, and the valley's a big bowl. So when we did get some stagnant air, you know, that just rolled in there and stayed for quite some time.
Sure. You have a second question? Sure. So I'm just trying to understand this structured. So as we read about fires and response to fires, the assumption in many cases is we're fighting the fires without an understanding of how many of those people involved with trying to save structures. And I'm not talking about communities. I'm talking about all the structures that are located throughout. And so I'm just trying to understand in relationship to trying to deal with the spread of the fire net versus structures. Is there somewhere to understand the resources in that takes versus trying to control the fire or stop the fire?
Yeah, Chair Evans, Representative Lively. You know, one of the neat things that occurs when the Conflagration Act is invoked by the governor is that those structural resources get sent to focus on the structures themselves. Okay. And this year we were really limited in the number of resources that were available, mainly the Type 1 hotshot crews and those wildland crews and then the engines that they could support it with. So if those structural resources weren't available, they would have to put their focus really on these communities. And so by putting in the structural assets, and the structural assets come with their own structural team as well, they focus on the communities, allowing then, especially on Checo and then even on Eagle Creek, the wildland resources to really start putting a plan together to corral the wildland piece. And so they have to work hand in hand to make that happen and make that occur. But that's what I saw this year, was really that partnership and focus on this, we'll focus on this, and then together collectively we'll focus on the bigger picture.
Jim, I might add that over the years, this process has become seamless. I don't think you can tell a structure firefight in terms in an urban interface now than a wildland fire, other than the patch on the shirt. We're integrating very well, as Jim highlighted, providing the perimeter control with the resources we have, the aviation assets, the tankers, the dozers, the hand crews, and burning off the back end of these structures. But we're not providing these structure protection. That's when we don't have that training and that personal protective equipment to get into the structure, on top of the structure, like the state fire marshals and fire service across the nation, across the state. I would also say that we train together annually. And our incident management teams, both the state fire marshals, which represents all the fire service across the state, and the ODF Wildland Fire, we integrate with our teams and train together, and it's a seamless transition in and out when the conflag is needed for structure protection.
Thank you.
One thing as we pivot to a question that Vice Chair Esquivel has is, just for the record, one of the things that is, and everybody on the panel has been very polite and nice about this, but I'll say it, when you get to the rural interface piece, people build they build houses and structures at a place that are really pretty, but often where winds want to take the fire when it's time. And every time you build in the rural interface, you are putting people's lives at risk, because at some point there will probably be somebody sent to go protect it. And there is a point where we need to find a balance of where we are building and not building, because at some point when we have a scarcity of resources, we just can't continue to reward bad judgment.
Yes, I didn't have a question. I just wanted to reiterate a little bit what I said in the last committee. My wife and I went from Medford to Sand Point, Idaho, which is about 635 miles. Of that, we only had clear sky to where we could see blue sky from Gilchrist to Redmond. The rest of Idaho, Washington, and Oregon was just like you've experienced the whole way. We couldn't even see the Columbia River.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative, if you look at that map, you can see my district was completely smoke-free.
Oh.
And you're very welcome. You're very welcome to come and clear your lungs.
Is that what you're into?
Good job. Okay. All right. Any one more time around the room for any questions? Seeing none. All right, here's the thank you all for everything you do. Please, I'm pretty certain that the tired fire guys and fire gals could care less that they hear something from legislators, but truly thanks for the willingness to answer the call. When I was younger and a lot lighter and perhaps smarter, answering those type of fire things used to be what I lived for. And I do know that it has a cost on the family. So thanks for what you guys do every day.
Thanks. We appreciate that. Thank you.
And I did notice that their 116th Air Patrol Squadron was not up on that list, even though they did send people. So we'll let that go for the day.
That's yours.
That's all right. So given the time of the day, what I'd like to suggest for the committee is discussion of committee bills be moved to November. But if you have ideas, now would be a good time after the committee to talk to people and lobby for that. I'm still trying to get clarity on how many I actually
get.
That's
what I was going to ask you, Dino.
I have been told one answer, but I'm not certain that that's the final answer. So before I start passing out committee bills, I want to get clarity just for my own sake, but I know that there's one or two out there that are floating. As we move toward November, a couple of things I just want to emphasize real quick while we have the time. I sent you out, hopefully you received it. The electronics have not been always perfect in the last couple weeks. I sent a trip report of conversations I had in Washington, D.C. on the Roseburg Veterans Home and on state and tribal cemeteries. I want to bring those up at this point because I'm going to hold at least one of the bills for committee bills for a mechanism for either of those projects, because we have committed to that already in terms of either money, additional money set aside for the Veterans Home project, or basically an approval of an application that may be relevant for the state and tribal cemetery. It may be able to be quite done in one bill, so I'm not going to take more than that. But that one is set aside just to keep faith with folks. Yes.
Just a quick question then, because I have two bills that constituents have brought to my attention that need tweaking. They're from last session. And so I don't know, I'm thinking amendments. So does that count? How does that work?
Amendments shouldn't count towards your
Yeah, but it's amending a bill that didn't. Well, one is amending a bill that did happen. One is bringing back a bill that didn't happen.
Which would be a new bill.
Which would be a new bill, yeah.
So several options on that. One is, again, I don't know how many committee bills we get.
Yeah.
We each supposedly get two individual bills.
You only get one.
And I know that in certain circumstances, magic can happen, and a bill can be written broad enough that there can have many different fruits to that tree. So if you can send the concepts over, let's see if we can find a path to meet everybody's needs. All right?
I just thought they'd be good for this committee.
And again,
Mr. Chair,
yeah.
A little history here. I think Representative Boone and myself remember that we've gone through this thing quite in the past. We went with a home in Lebanon for veterans with the intent that Roseburg would be next. And that was the plan at the time. I don't know what's happened to it, but I don't think we should get off that track at all, because that's something we talked about 10 years ago.
And to that point, it's a good way to close. To that point, I want to publicly commend Director Smith and the folks at the USVA who were strangely available in terms of, I ended up having 7 different meetings with different VA folks. Met with Congressman Walden for 30 minutes, actually, Congressman DeFazio, Congressman Schrader, staffs of the senators, and what we have right now is a plan, and again, there's always words with that, but a plan to do something very distinct, as the director talked about earlier, with the Roseburg home, that is going to hopefully be a pilot for something called the Trajectory of Care, which would include assisted living and include memory care and include perhaps a redefined version of what a domiciliary can provide for folks that have a need for a place to live, as well as language most likely in the next Congress, but targeting changing some of the barriers to reimbursement for assisted living, as well as support for 1 to maybe 3, but probably 1 to 2 tribal state cemeteries for the state of Oregon. We are a priority. There are 5 states that have, in their little formula, not enough state cemeteries, or at least places that they want to build. Oregon happens to be one, and when we suggested some relationships and partnerships between a county, a tribe, and the state, they were very excited about that. So you have the TRIP report. That TRIP report, by the way, has been approved by the folks that I had the meetings with, so it does reflect the actual conversations. The question is what we do forward, and hopefully by November I'll have some things to report on that. In the meantime, please focus on, if you have some time, what you're going to need to make the work groups relevant as we get prepared for the February session. If there's support that the new staff or I or anybody else in the process can provide, please let us know. Any questions for me before we close out today? All right. Thanks for enjoying a very informative afternoon, and I'm going to try to get you out on time. You're now adjourned. Thank you, sir. Now adjourned. Thank you, sir.